Are you a speech language pathologist or occupational therapist who is feeling the squeeze of high caseloads and limited support? Wondering if maybe private practice is the answer? Well, let's talk about it. Join me for a free training on May 6th at 8 p.m. Eastern, where we will explore what it really takes to leave the schools and start your own private practice in 2024. We're talking about the ability to have a flexible schedule, choose your own clients, create your own caseload cap, and uncap your earning potential by leaving salary ladders and scales behind so that you can finally earn what you're worth. Join me for a free training on May 6th at 8 p.m. Eastern, where we will explore what it really takes to leave the schools and start your own private practice in 2024. We're talking about the ability to have a flexible schedule, choose your own clients, create your own caseload cap, and uncap your earning potential by leaving salary ladders and scales behind so that you can finally earn what you're worth. Don't just dream about having better work-life balance. Make it your reality by starting your own private practice. To register, just head on over to privatepracticetraining.com right now and sign up, and I'll see you there. Emily Gavin is an occupational therapist and dementia care coach with a private practice called Philly Care Coaching in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. She decided to take the leap into private practice with encouragement from her peers and her spouse after being laid off from her job. I've gotten to know Emily during her time in both the Start and Grow Your Private Practice programs, and it has been so cool to watch her grow her specialty-based private practice of working with people with dementia and their families and have that bloom into a successful private practice. In this episode, she talks about her journey from working in the SNFs and inpatient rehab to owning her own business. Emily also shares how caring for her mother-in-law with dementia inspired her special interest. If you've been thinking about starting a coaching-based private practice and want to learn more, this is a must-listen episode, so stay tuned. I'm Jenna Castro-Casbon, CEO of The Independent Clinician and founder of Private Practice School. First, I started my own private practice. And then over the past 15 years, I've worked with over 10,000 SLPs and OTs to start and grow their successful private practices so they can have more freedom, flexibility, fulfillment, and finances. I created the Private Practice Success Stories podcast to share what's possible for you, your family, your clients, and your community when you choose private practice. We'll share everything from small private practice side hustles to flexible lifestyle private practices to traditional brick and mortar practices and everything in between. You'll meet regular clinicians just like you who followed our steps and are now living their private practice dreams. If they can do it, you can do it too. So let's get started. All right, so before we dive in, can you please share your name, your location, and the name of your private practice?
Yes, my name is Emily Gavin. I am in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and my practice is Philly Care Coaching.
I'm so excited to do this with you, Emily. I've gotten to know you in both the Start and Now Grow programs. I've watched your growth and I've watched how things are going for you, and we'll share that part with our listeners in a second. But before we get there, can you please share a little bit about your early career or your career in general? And then share also, when did you start thinking about private practice?
So this is my second career, occupational therapy. I had a 17-year career in IT. And in 2009, a dear friend of mine died of brain cancer. And it was one of those life is short moments. And I really wanted a career that played to my strengths, that was more aligned with who I am and brought me into relationship with people and not just screens.
Yes. I don't obviously love that happened, right? But I love that it got you to a place where you had that moment that recentered you, it sounds like, and got you like kind of back on track about making sure that you were doing what you were meant to do in life.
Yes, absolutely. And I loved being a student. I absolutely loved grad school. And then my first couple jobs were kind of disasters. I started in inpatient rehab and that did not go well because I had not had any kind of rehab-based fieldwork experience. And so third field work and lasted just about as long. And then I ended up in a skilled nursing facility, long-term care facility for about 10 months. And I think I lost about 20, 25 pounds during that job just from sheer misery. So those were not good times, but I did learn a ton. And I noticed when I was working in SNF, A, that I had no idea how to work with people with dementia, and B, that nobody else around me really did either. So that ended up being pretty important in my career. I was pretty appalled by the sort of the dehumanizing conditions in long-term care, and that stuck with me. So I had a brief foray where I was like, well, maybe it's time for private practice. And that was 2013. And that is when I bought your ebook and I got my NPI and I got my liability insurance. And I treated two people doing chronic pain management, which was a very strong interest of mine. Also something where I felt like we don't do this well as a system. Then I ended up getting two part-time jobs that meshed together, one in home care and one in a PACE program, a program of all-inclusive care for the elderly. And that's when I started really having fun and realizing that OT was not a terrible mistake.
Yes, well, because you might have been feeling that way, right? Like, and sometimes it takes a while for us to find what we like. And oftentimes it's by figuring out what we don't like, right? Like sometimes people figure out what they like right away and they just run right toward it. And other times people kind of need to have some experiences. They're like, well, this isn't it, to kind of narrow things down and figure out what it was. But I think it takes all types of professionals to work with all types of people, right? And dementia is certainly a more challenging clinical population and just more misunderstood, I think, by both professionals and everyone. So I love that it was something for you that you liked doing and that you felt called to make changes about. And so I think that that's really awesome.
Then after only, I think, 3 years of clinical work, I became the manager of the rehab department at the PACE program. I did that for 8 years. And during that time, I always kind of wanted to have some skills in my back pocket because there was a little bit of imposter syndrome going on there. Am I really an OT if I only practiced for 3 years? And am I a good manager? I always felt that I still was an OT because my client was my therapy team. And my job was to help them function to their best ability and have good quality of life. I also felt like I was the OT for the organization. And in the course of that job, I decided to really pursue learning more about dementia and trying to improve the way that organization cared for people with dementia. That's sort of the skills that I was collecting. I got some instructor certifications and various things and did a lot of classroom training. I really sort of started narrowing down because I started with this classroom training and I was like, this is great, but I don't know that it's actually creating change. I started moving into sort of more of a problem-focused model where if there was a difficult situation with a participant with dementia, I would go and observe what was going on with the aides and what the care looked like. And then I would do some specific focused training with those aides, almost more coaching, because there you're not sitting in an in-service for 4 hours and waiting for some kind of shift to happen in your practice. You're actually, oh, this person is maybe going to hurt me and I should learn how to deal with them a little better. There's some motivation there.
Oh, yeah. Well, so it sounds like you got training in like a couple different things, right? So not only were you like clinical training in dementia and all that kind of stuff, but you also were becoming a manager, right? Like you were managing people. So you had that aspect and then the teaching component too. So that's like a pretty robust amount of skills that you are developing in a pretty short period of time. Well, so what happened next?
So next, one thing I'm really happy about is that in the summer of 22, I did some serious work in therapy on that imposter syndrome and really did my best to kick it to the curb because I do not need that. None of us do.
Would you be willing to share anything that helped you kick it to the curb, right? Because I know that there's probably people listening to this who are like, oh my God, yes, me too. And I've either been wanting to kick it to the curb or I've tried, but I just can't seem to shake it. So without getting too personal, perhaps, could you please share anything that helped you move past it?
One thing that really helped was a book by Marcus Buckingham called Love and Work, or Love Plus Work. Really great book. I spent that summer really examining my own strengths, really getting familiar with my sort of my natural inclinations. We were mentioning zones of genius and understanding the value that I bring to my work. And that introspection, as well as the support of a good therapist to figure out some of the reasons why I was worried about the rug being pulled out from under me all the time, was really super helpful.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And I think that that's one of those things is that when people are struggling with imposter syndrome, it's kind of pervasive, unfortunately, in our fields, right? Whether you're an OT or an SLP, it's very prevalent in women and in high achieving women, which is what like all of us are, right? So it's a similar feeling that lots of us have, but like the root of the cause might be a little different for person to person. So I really applaud you for kind of going deep on that and realizing like, hey, this is actually holding me back and I need to do some deep work here to move past this. Otherwise, I'm going to stay stuck with this imposter syndrome thing and not be able to reach my full potential as an occupational therapist or as a manager or as a person, right? So I'm happy for you that you did that, for all of us to take a step back and think whatever is stopping us from moving forward into living our best life or whatever, I think we should make a plan to work through that.
I'm really glad I did that in 22 because in May of 23, I got laid off. And big surprise, except that I'd been sort of preparing for it for the last 10 years.
It was a big surprise.
And I'm so glad that I did that work because when I got there, it just didn't feel personal. It felt economic. That made it, I think, a completely different experience than it would have been.
We're also in the type of professions that don't typically get laid off, right? Like, or people say that speech and OT are very air quotes stable professions, right? That are always in demand. So when things like that happen, it can be really shocking and scary to people. But it sounds like you handled it very well based on the personal work that you had done not too long before.
When that happened, it was this huge catalyst. So I spent the next 10 weeks, this was at the beginning of May, I spent the next 2 weeks talking to everybody on the phone, in person, friends, colleagues, telling me that there is a need for the services that I can provide. There is a need for my skills and I am the person to do it. So May 23rd, I looked at how I bought the START program and really just dove in and got my LLC at the beginning of June.
And we'll talk about what you're doing now. But when you first started, did you know that you definitely wanted to do like just dementia? Or did you want to do a number of different things?
I knew I wanted to focus on dementia. I also had just finished an advanced practice certificate in coaching. Been working on my post-professional doctorate since 2019, which was actually something that I haven't mentioned is that in 2014, my wife and I moved in with her parents to care for my mother-in-law who had Parkinson's and dementia. And so there was definitely not just a professional inspiration, but also a personal one as I went through that time leading up to her death in 2019 and going through the experience of being a manager and an OT and having the opportunity to really kind of go deep on some of those skills.
Amazing. How lucky for your wife and your mother-in-law that you had those skills and that you were able to, I'm sure, help in numerous ways. And so you decided to start your practice maybe a little bit out of necessity, right? When all of a sudden you had this layoff situation. And so it sounds like you joined the program, you got your LLC. How long did it take you to get your first client?
I got my first client on the day after Labor Day. We had decided to not cancel the big vacation and went to Paris and went to Scotland. And I came home and in mid-July, I announced on Facebook that I was opening up. And then it was early September, I got my first email.
And can you tell actually our listeners, what did that feel like to work with your first private client?
It was great. My first client, it felt wonderful. It felt freeing and exciting and challenging. I had taken on training called Skills to Care, which is an evidence-based program developed at Thomas Jefferson University. It focuses on caregivers, OT for caregivers, basically. And so that gave a lot of structure to what I was offering. And having that structure as I was starting something so new and different, and as I was coming back to clinical work for the first time in 8 years, was a really great thing.
It really is special, that first client, right? And either it's wonderful or every now and then it's not. My first client was, I had two first clients really in the first week, and one of them was wonderful and the other one, let's just say, was not. But that's okay because I learned a lot from that experience as well. But either way, there's a difference when all of a sudden you're in control of the situation, right? You're in control of the clinical care and you're in control of things like the frequency and most cases, the payer source and all those kind of things. The other thing I really think is cool about your story, Emily, is not only do you have these clinical skills that help clients, but you also have this coaching skill and additional clinical skills that help caregivers. So tell our listeners a little bit about, again, how your practice is set up in terms of who's kind of, air quotes, on your caseload. Is it mostly clients, the people with dementia, or is it more of the caregivers?
It's really more of the caregivers, but there is this way that if I'm working directly with the person with dementia, at least to the extent of doing a thorough OT evaluation, doing repeated cognitive testing so that I can establish a pattern of performance, and I'm not just looking at one little snapshot of a point in time, but I'm actually able to get to know them a little bit. And I'm using Allen Disabilities Model. The assessments that go with that are very activity-based and very functional. It's not like doing the MoCA to get somebody's cognitive level where bringing it down to pencil and paper, which can be useful, but understanding them in the whole context of how different cognitive levels are able to function is tremendously useful in figuring out how to coach caregivers on how to communicate, how to simplify tasks, how to support the care recipient in functioning to their best ability. So understanding when you don't have the just right challenge, when you don't have a match between ability and task. And so you need to adjust one by giving a little help or the other by bringing down the complexity of the task. And so helping to match all that up is really key to what I'm doing. And the caregiver is really the focus of change in that therapeutic relationship. So I'm assessing the person with dementia a ton on a Medicare case, but all the intervention is pretty much directed to the caregiver. One thing that we might do is think of activities and sensory experiences that they can open up for the person they're caring for to just improve their overall quality of life and reduce difficult behaviors.
Yeah. Hi there, Jenna Castor-Casbon here, and I hope that you're loving the episode so far. Chances are you've been listening to this podcast for a while and soaking up a ton of information from myself and our guests, and it's time to make the shift from dreaming to doing and go from inspiration to implementation. Successful private practices don't build themselves. At The Independent Clinician, we help regular SLPs and OTs become successful private practitioners using our proven systems. No more guessing, no more Googling, no more sleepless nights stressing about legalities. We can help you just like we've helped the guests featured on this show. They didn't guess or stress their way through private practice. Instead, they got step-by-step help along the way, and we're excited to help you too. If you need help to get set up and started with private clients on the side, the Start Your Private Practice program is perfect for you. If you've already started and you want to transition into full-time private practice and be successful once you're there, the Grow Your Private Practice program is your next step. To learn more about our programs, go to independentclinician.com. Now back to the episode.
I hope this is an okay parallel to draw, but so my wife is a physical therapist who does early intervention. Mm-hmm. And so she does work with the kids, but she's working also a lot with the parents, right? Because she's only there for an hour a week or whatever it is, right? And so the parents in that case need to understand how to continue the work while she's not there, right? So I would imagine that a lot of the spouses or caregivers that you're doing this coaching with, you also can't be there all the time, right? And so they need to have these tools and skills to be able to help their person all the time, like even when you're not there, right?
Absolutely. It's not the kind of thing where I could come in twice a week and do a sensory intervention or an activity and have that make a whole week's worth of 24/7 care easier. But if a caregiver is providing that kind of stimulation every day, that's going to make their 24/7 care easier.
I love thinking about that differently, because I would imagine that there's some people who are listening to this right now who maybe work with kids, right? And they haven't really thought about dementia care, but they're now thinking like, hey, this is like kind of similar to what I'm doing. It's just at a different age group, right? Or a different population. So how did you get your next clients?
I was working my network really hard. My father-in-law also now has Alzheimer's. And I went to the social worker at his memory care clinic and said, hey, we've worked together before. This is what I'm doing now. And I've gotten some really great referrals from them. I also have an amazing colleague who is a geriatric care manager, social worker, sort of advisor who's in private practice. And she was one of the earliest people to really encourage me and say, you can do this. This is so needed. And she's given me great referrals.
This is definitely one of those types of populations that there are established services for this group of individuals, right? And so as a private practitioner, it's like, okay, how do I tap into the services or the other professionals that are part of the care of people with dementia? So you're right. So like geriatric social workers, neurologists, gerontologists, any sort of dementia support groups, Alzheimer's Association, walks, all kinds of other things, right? So I love that that is great for you to be able to utilize that network. And because you've been doing this for a while, and probably also because of your former position, you probably do have a good network of people that you can be like, hey, this is what I'm doing now.
And you're right. I bet you lots of people are like, oh my gosh, that is so necessary. The second I hear of anyone who could be appropriate for you, I'm going to send them your way.
Having been laid off, actually about 5 or 6 months shy of my public service loan forgiveness, I really needed to get some employment for a nonprofit. Although it's resulted in an insane fall with tons and tons of work, I figured out that if I got one job in a nonprofit, I would have to work 40 hours a week. But if you have two part-time jobs, then the requirement for loan forgiveness is 30 hours. So my friends and colleagues totally came through and I got two different part-time jobs to total 30 hours a week through the rest of this year. And I had then a full day that I could devote to the private practice. I also opened up some hours on Sunday. That's kind of been my fall.
Such a victory. Listeners, I know that if you are in that position, either you've made your last loan payment or you're looking forward to that day, I know that you are cheering Emily on and knowing what a big deal that is. Emily, I'm just so proud of you for like just doing what you had to do. Sometimes different financial things happen and people just, you gotta make it work, right? And you make it work for a time period that you need to make it work. And then you won't need to make it work anymore, right? You'll have more room for other things. And so with that kind of on the horizon, what does the next kind of phase of your private practice look like?
Well, I am wrapping up an adjuncting job at Thomas Jefferson right now, and my Fridays are now opening up. So I'm opening up another day of treatment. So the next phase is just really going to be ramping up. This month, I'm going full tilt back on the marketing to try and fill up that day once I hit January and I don't have that anymore. The great thing about working those part-time jobs through this period is that for a number of months, I was also collecting severance. So I was able to build up a little bit of a buffer to carry me through weaning off of those part-time jobs. So I will be weaning off and cutting back gradually as I ramp up, and I'm doing some telehealth, a lot of home visits. That's kind of where I am now.
I love that. When I love that, again, you're just making it work, right? You've got certain things lined up, but you also have a goal for when you're not going to need that anymore, right? And like, I love that you're already thinking about marketing, that at the time of this recording, it's December, which is kind of like a weird time with holidays and all that kind of other thing. But the energy of January is huge, right? Like everyone has New Year's resolutions and wants to get stuff happening. So now really, even before we get to January, is the time to start like making those connections and saying, listen, come January, I'm going to be open on these days, right? And again, when you offer such a unique and needed service, the best strategy, listeners, is to just talk to as many people as possible, right? And so literally just sit down with a blank piece of paper and write down what I call pockets of people, right? Who are the pockets of people who also know your clients, and really think as outside of the box as you can for anyone who could possibly know your ideal clients or professionals who work with your ideal client. So I know, Emily, you're in the Grow program now. We talk about setting up a referral engine and really making those networking connections and everything, because those can lead to not only clients, right? But it can also lead to contracts, and it could lead to all kinds of other things that can grow your practice.
Whenever I've heard you and the START crowd talking about school contracts, I've kind of been like, oh, well, yeah, it's a Pete's thing.
Good for them.
Good for them. But I started thinking about what might be the equivalent in my world. And I actually, just a couple days ago, got a LinkedIn request for a connection from the owner of a non-medical home care in my area. And I've been building a big network on LinkedIn. I have been sort of cultivating those connections a little bit. And I got up the guts when I got this request. I said, thanks for the request and for the connection. If you ever have any difficult dementia cases or want some really focused problem-based training for your aides, let me know. And he said, let's have coffee next week. I'd love to learn more about your business. And I'm thinking, contract. And there are a ton of little non-medical home care companies all over the place. And I think that might be rich for needing my services.
Totally. 100%. And I'm thinking too, just I've had family members who've been in assisted livings, long-term cares, and anything else. And the individuals, the residents, or they get a certain types of services or whatever, but the caregivers don't really, right? People just say like, oh, here's a number for a support group. Like, good luck to you. But like, people are often looking for more than just a support group or books. And so I think that if you can also tap into facilities who maybe want to hire you, or maybe don't, but maybe they're happy to refer caregivers to you, mm-hmm. right? Then that's an awesome other source of referrals. And that maybe isn't like a conflict to them at all, because they're not offering that service and they're happy to tell Mrs. Jones to call you up, right?
I have pages and pages of pockets of people. And my challenge has been having the time to really create and nurture all those connections. And I'm really looking forward to diving in further and really finding the places. I mean, I have this list of adult daycare centers in my area, and I've worked with one senior center. I did a talk there. I did a talk at a Rotary Club, and I did a talk at Philadelphia Corporation for Aging that has just got me a client this week. All those ideas are things that I'm really looking forward to just plowing into.
Well, and now you'll have the time. That's one of the challenging things sometimes when people are just starting their practices, especially if they've started on the side of their job, which, listeners, is what I recommend that people do, because I really strongly believe that it's the best way to get started. However, it's not the best way to grow, right? Because all of a sudden you're completely maxed out, and it gets to be a point where you kind of have to make a choice. How are you going to allot your time, right? Now, for you, Emily, the decision was made for you in terms of being laid off, for better or worse. But for other people, they really have to make that decision and say, okay, is the potential for my practice growing to the point that I'm actually like losing money by staying at my day job? And so I think that it's very exciting when people get to the point where you're kind of at now, where you see some light at the end of the tunnel in terms of having more time, right? And so now you can put your energy into making those relationships, or maybe you already have some of the relationships, but developing them further. Another thing that we really emphasize in Grow is creating systems around that, so that you have like an actual system for when are you reaching out to people and how often are you doing so, and so that you can track that and also figure out which of these referral relationships are leading to clients versus which of them maybe aren't or whatever. And that takes a little while to figure out. But nonetheless, like, you are really headed in the right direction in terms of growing your practice. And again, I know that you have tremendous skills and an amazing heart to want to help the world be a better place. And so I know that your practice is going to thrive, and there's going to be so many people who've been looking for your services, but didn't know that they existed. Your job over the next couple of months is to make sure that people know about you and know that you exist, and they're going to be so excited to refer people your way.
I'm really excited. The fact that this is actually happening after all these years of being like, well, maybe I'll do that, because I could never, I mean, a PACE program where I worked for 10 years is not a traditional type of setting. It's very different. It's a preventive model of care, which doesn't otherwise exist in this country. And the structure of rehab in that setting is very different. I could never go back to a traditional OT job. And I was always really worried about that because I was like, if things don't work out in this job, it's not like I'm going to go be a rehab manager in a SNF, because that is not a place that I want to be. And the pressure and the exploitation of healthcare workers has gotten so much worse in that time. This is where it's at.
This is where it's at, I think, for the profession, right? But also, obviously, for you personally. But I'm just so excited for you, Emily, for finding your own pocket, as it were, within the profession, right? And being able to, again, to tap into these skills, tap into your personal experience, and be able to bring a service to your community that is much needed and kind of exists maybe, but like doesn't exist enough. And so good for you for bringing it forward and helping people in the Philadelphia area and perhaps beyond. So if any of our listeners who have been listening to the show would like to learn more about you, is there anywhere online that we could send them?
Yes, you can find me on Facebook under Philly Care Coaching, Instagram under Philly Care Coaching. Soon to have a Philly Care Coaching page on LinkedIn as well. Right now, I just have my personal page under Emily Gavin.
Love it. Well, thank you so much for being on. Thank you for sharing your story and for inspiring our listeners to think differently and create a private practice that's a little bit outside of the box.
Thank you so much. And thank you for all of your guidance. I would not be here without you. And I'm incredibly grateful. So
my clients really are SLPs and OTs now, right? Like I'm an adult-focused private practitioner and adult-focused SLP by background. But now, again, my air quotes clients are professionals. And it's really fun to evolve over the course of your career and serve different types of people in different ways. So thank you, Emily, for being part of our programs and for trusting me and trusting yourself to make this happen.
Thank you.
Okay, don't you just love Emily? I love how she overcame her imposter syndrome to start her private practice. She is a perfect example of someone who is dissatisfied with the way that things were and channeled that into a successful business focused on helping caregivers and people with dementia, which is her special interest. If you would like to learn more about our programs and how we can help support you, just like we supported Emily, please visit privatepracticeschool.com. As always, thank you for listening, and please tune in next week for another episode of the Private Practice Success Stories podcast. Till then.
Well, this episode might be over, but we don't have to say goodbye. Head on over to independentclinician.com for resources that will help you at each stage of your private practice journey. If you're on Instagram, let's connect. Follow me and send me a DM. I'm at Independent Clinician. And if you're on Facebook, make sure that you join the SLP and OT Private Practice Beginners Facebook group. All right, off to help more regular SLPs and OTs become successful private practitioners. Let me know if I can help you too.